Unlike her father, Tracy Saxby clung to her ambition. With Siemens, she had travelled through most of Europe, in particular France, Germany, and Switzerland, making many contacts in the world of business, particularly in the buzzing area of international finance. One of these contacts was with the bank Credit Suisse, which eventually offered her a job as assistant manager, investments, in their London office. This she accepted and was told the appointment would start with a 9-month course in their Zurich office. On arrival among the legendary gnomes, she discovered the bank had rented a pleasant little villa for her on the lakeside, big enough for 3 or 4 people. After a few weeks, Tracy began to get a conscience about her father, whom she hadn't seen or called as often as she should. These qualms were the direct result of a long, rambling letter Lenny had written to congratulate her on the new job. This led to her telephoning and inviting him to come over and stay for a week or so. "I mean, we could go out to dinner in the evenings, spend Sundays together. It would be nice." "You really want me to come?" He knew that he'd been less than a good father and felt not truly guilty, but certainly a sense of shame, a job not completed. "Of course, Dad, please." Tracy sounded quite genuine, as though she was trying to forge a new bond with him. Perhaps a break would do him good, he thought, recharge his batteries, renew his vigour in the search for his nemesis, Ronnie Richardson. He found Zurich oppressive, with its temples to the Swiss franc and the somewhat dour men and women who seemed to go about their work with a resigned and serious air. But he liked Tracy's villa and trips out on the lake during the day. He also enjoyed the restaurants, talking with his daughter in the evenings, sometimes late into the night. The trip started to take his mind off the enormous bleakness that had pervaded his life. After a week or so, Tracy suggested that he should come to the bank and take her out to lunch, because she had a particularly long lunch hour that day. He arrived a little before noon and sat alone, being eyed suspiciously by cashiers and one security man. Then, just as he was becoming uncomfortable and thinking he should have waited outside, he heard someone speak in English. "Ah, Mr. Ungerford, how nice to see you. You've come to see Herr Schenk?" "Yes, he's expecting me, I think." Saxby knew the voice, would have known it anywhere. He glanced up and to his right. Ronnie Richardson was being shown into an office, welcomed by a tall, grave-looking suit who was nearly smiling a welcome. Len Saxby's brain seemed to drain, his vision clouded with blood, then blacked out. Slowly his sight returned. He stood up, felt his legs shaky under him. His sense of balance deserted him so that he clutched at the nearby wall. He must have looked terrible, because the security man came over and spoke to him in his sing-song Hochdeutsch, but Saxby waved him away and blundered into the street. How Ronnie, who had this almost wizardly facility for spotting danger a mile away, was not aware of Saxby's presence is difficult to explain. He did not know until much later how Saxby had picked him up, and even when faced with facts, he refused to believe them, as you will surely see. One can only put it down to a sudden lapse of concentration as his mind shifted onto the question of finance on entering the bank. Tracy came down the bank steps, followed outside by the security man in his crisp and correct blue uniform.
"You okay, Dad? You ill or something?"
The security man spoke to her, his head bent near her ear, and his lips moving urgently.
"Titus says you look ill. What is it?"
"Nothing, bit faint. I've come over faint. Be all right in a minute. Haven't had anything but coffee this morning."
"Dad, you're not looking after yourself. Come on, let's get some food into you."
She steered him toward a restaurant frequented by bank staff and ordered his favourite pork chops on a bed of pasta. Lenny Saxby had to concentrate hard to hold down his need to ask questions about the man who called himself Hungerford. He was conscious of the twitch in his mind being transferred to his cheek and left eye. He was short of breath and had to force himself to make small talk.
"Your mum would have liked it here, Trace."
"You ever hear from her?"
She knew that normally her mother was a taboo subject.
"No, and I don't want to hear her news, Tracy. Please, just let it lie."
The conversation stuttered, hesitated, then dried up. When the coffee was served, he casually said he'd seen an Englishman being welcomed into the bank. "Hungerford, I think they called him.
Oh, yes, he's a writer. Well looked after by the bank. Rather a prize, I think. Lives somewhere on Lake Maggiore and comes up to see the great Herr Schenk every couple of months or so.
Who's Herr Schenk?
Herr Schenk was the top account manager who dealt only with the seriously wealthy. Later she asked him how he planned to spend his afternoon.
What? Oh, maybe I'll go out on the lake.
She sighed, concerned, for her father seemed distant. Somehow his body was there with her, but his mind had moved away, concentration gone. Yet that evening he seemed completely changed. It's as though he suddenly got a new lease on life, she told the dark, hunky cashier who was trying to get into her pants. At the time she thought that maybe his luck was starting to change, and her father's luck as well. So it began. Now he'd found Richardson, there was a new and furtive purpose to life. Once he'd traced his quarry to the pink and white villa teetering above the lake, Saxby's whole being altered, his mind consumed with the mechanics required to eliminate the perceived designer of his downfall. His target, he decided, would have to die in the most efficient manner of his devising. He owed it to his military training. He first spotted Richardson in Zurich during the early summer of the year previous to the discontented winter, when the newlywed Bex Gauntlet tracked Tess Murray from Dublin to Bern and onward. So Saxby's plan had several months to mature. The stalking of Ronnie Richardson was followed closely by the setting up of what Saxby, deep in his secret self, thought of as death by stealth. Those months were spent arranging the hardware and carrying it to the final destination. He had been lucky not to be detected immediately, and by the time he finally traced Richardson to the lakeside retreat outside Brissago, Saxby knew that his one-time comrade was quietly displaying every facet of a man carefully watching his back, a man great with caution, suffused in cunning, fermented in fear. Lenny had no idea of the enormity of Ronnie Richardson's secret, but he knew it existed, just as he was certain the man would rightly die for the sorrow he had heaped upon the head of his judge, jury, and executioner. Over the next few months, Lenny Saxby made a number of visits to Switzerland, always giving himself a reason to be there. First it was to see his daughter while she was still in Zurich, then devious journeys to the canton of Ticino, taking pains to vary the route, mostly by train, for that was the cheapest way, staying in different places and keeping himself distant from his target. Later he told Tracy that he was taking a look at Switzerland, while he had the chance and the excuse.
Sort of fallen in love with it, Trace. Such a different country. So many things going on. Not like old England.
He even managed to rent a couple of rooms in Ascona, to which address he mailed pieces of his stripped-down Glock, which is conveniently made of a durable plastic, and so avoided the dangerous business of bringing the weapon through a Swiss customs point, where the uniformed men were unsmiling, taking themselves seriously. In Ascona, where they were used to artists, he became an artistic photographer, hiring a small fishing boat fitted with an outboard motor. He would sail out and take photographs of the lakeside with an expensive camera. Many of those photographs were of the Villa Myrta from the lake. He also made a number of covert reconnaissance sorties, swimming into Richardson's boathouse, then tracing the pathway up to the rear door of the villa. Here he encountered indications that the owner was intent on maintaining privacy. Invisible eyes ran a three-tier barrier, safer than razor wire, around the outer perimeter of the villa's grounds. And Lenny used his considerable expertise, learned and sharpened back in the SAS, to deactivate the sensitive mechanisms. Then, over three nights, he examined the sophisticated electronic alarms on the doors and windows. It did not take him long to discover that these electronic guards on the main house were beyond his skills. Indeed, they would have defeated most burglars or criminals, for Ronnie Richardson had not relied solely on alarms and triggers available on the commercial market. With ingenuity, he had adapted many standard systems so that they were booby-trapped. Anyone tampering with the doors or windows would most likely trigger a secondary, or in some cases a tertiary device. The alarms were sensitive as nervous black mambas and twice as deadly.